this whole China thing was kind of quirky to me anyway, the way they were with the zero policy COVID thing. But look at it through a different lens. Look at it through the food shortage lens. They locked down 100 million people in those little cubicles, and they reduced their diet from 2,500 or 3,000 calories a day to $1,200 or 1,200 calories a day. Delivered to them. So they just knocked out a huge amount of extra calories that could then be moved around the rest of the country. So you're looking at it, is it a forced calorie reduction or is it really a zero COVID policy? And good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining today. Brighteon TV, David Dubine here from Adapt 2030. We've seen our world slowly unravel with the disconnection of supply chains, the liquidation of finance and industry, constriction of crops, food prices rising. So what does 2023 hold for us? Because you can clearly see that it's a game plan and we're moving from point A to point B. So if you know where point B is in the future, we can just trace our steps back as to what's the trajectory? Where are we going to move? What could you expect as we get into the next phase of plans for restructuring of society and moving us into digital currencies? Well, I got five different aspects here of things to look for in 2023. Like the change of the world that we're seeing right now is affecting everyone. So all of us combined with solutions can find our way out of this or survive through it in a manner which would continue to allow us to have abundant lifestyles and live in luxury instead of going back to serfdom and sleeping with the pigs in the back of the barn on some straw. Not a fan, don't want to go there. 0% chance I'm going there, and I don't want any of you going in that direction either. So if we can share some of the data points today, perhaps this will help you allow your families to get more prepared in your communities, start those conversations with people about starting to work together. It will be a community effort. There will be no lone wolves that will move through this. So how do you explain it to somebody else? Well, it's going to require some fact to at least explain the problem first. I know, I hear this all the time. Oh, you're too negative. I don't want to hear about that. Oh, it'll get better. It'll this, it'll X, Y, Z. Well, just framing it a little bit differently. Hey, did you hear about the Tonga eruption? Hey, did you hear about these extreme weather events? So I wanted to run through a few data points. And as you can see on the beginning here, this is Ulamaru, or otherwise known as Ayers Rock. So down in New South Wales, they've had the largest floods in the last 1,000 years, three times in three storms. It's decimated and ruined probably 95 to 98% of the wheat crop coming out of New South Wales. So this was an artist's rendition of the floods that were in the desert moving and water bodies filling back up into massive lakes and estuaries. So the bird populations, the fish populations, desert-wise, riverbound is going to explode. So if nature does throw something in destruction in one fashion, you could look to nature to provide bounty in another one. So yeah, the wheat is sprouting on the head standing in the field because, well, it's too wet. And look at the deserts now blooming and turning into wildlife paradise, verdant milk and honey. The ultimate wild card in everything you're seeing, if you frame the reference of looking at all these changes in terms of food supply and cycles repeating, how will the food supply be affected most? Now, we could talk about climate change all day long, 100-year projections, but what we have in play is the Tonga eruption. Now, you may have seen the prior programs that are done exclusively on Tonga, the eruption, the density of ash and water vapor, and the height that it reached in the atmosphere. It's the largest eruption in 200 years. So what we're looking at here is the ultimate fallout. The thing was with the ash and the sulfur dioxide, it wasn't at levels that we saw on land-based eruptions. This was a water vapor event. So as we look through the timeline on this, we're approaching the one-year mark. As we come into January 15th, we'll be at the one-year mark. So based on Pinatubo's eruption profile, coming up to the one-year mark, we should be getting near maximum effects of cooling in the atmosphere. And that should drag on for approximately 3 months, and then we'll come to the ultimate cooling at that point. Now that will run for a full year, and then we should start to exit out of, and the water vapor and particulates in the atmosphere should start to thin, and temperature should return back to normal again, meaning crop production, planting and harvesting dates will be returned back to, we can get food again. But for right now, these next 2 years, we are heading into a year without a summer, absolutely. And this is the reason that a lot of things you're seeing right now. So look at it in different optics. Now, since the programs that I'd done here on Brighteon TV on the live broadcast here, 2 to 3 p.m. every Friday on the ADAPT 2030 show, this chart that I'm showing you here was not available. And the scary thing is they're only releasing July data now, but what month are we in? We're in December. That's 5 months delay. What is the problem with the readings of water vapor and changes of pressure in the atmosphere and Kelvin temperature drop? Now, degrees Kelvin is very similar to degrees Celsius or degrees Fahrenheit. It's a measurement off of a baseline, and it's similar to Celsius, up 10, down 10. And we are looking at closer to 10 degree Fahrenheit drop across anywhere in blue you see in the southern hemisphere. Well, that was all the ash that got circulated in the cloud cells down after the eruption and water vapor down into the southern pole. Well, do you think that's going to affect crop production through the southern part of South America? It's brushing Australia, and they're getting these once in a thousand year storms and really unbelievably cold temperatures heading into summer. But think about your summer temperature average. If it was 10 or 12 degrees Fahrenheit below the normal, weather systems would be off. They'd be colliding, a lot more rainfall. Things just wouldn't sync up. Now, another gem here I was able to find, once I knew what I was looking for in the pressure readings, then I moved over to 30 millibar here. And thank you, Severe Weather EU, for putting this chart out. This one here shows similarly to what was shown in the last chart, but you get very specific on where the cooling is start to pronounce itself and bend out of that constricted zone in the southern hemisphere. This is going to start moving back northward again up into the zones growing wheat, corn, soy, barley, sorghum in the southern hemisphere. So as we march forward, if you've seen any of the planting data, oh my, it is looking traumatic at best and complete loss at worst. So this is the New Zealand temperature delta from just the beginning of December here. What do you see going into summer? See, this is the most important thing. They're not going into winter, they're going into summer. Meteorological summer, heat summer, what we would consider late June into July in the Northern Hemisphere temperatures is where they should be right now heading into their summer. But how much of a drop? That's over 2 degrees Celsius drop. And if you know anything about crop production, 2 degrees Celsius is what caused widespread famines in 1816 across Europe. And anything at minus 3 degrees Celsius was a no-grow. So just temperature comparisons from 1816 after the Tambora eruption in 1815. And now we're starting to see the exact same temperature profiles and drops in temperature that we see in this Tonga eruption a year after, coming into 2023. So the parallels are so stark, and they're actually frightening once you start to look into the data. So now we see it in Australia. We see it in New Zealand. Where else are we going to see it? Oh, let's look in Argentina. Start to see the drops in temperature on the Brazilian border there. Also with Uruguay, which I featured in the last video here on Brighteon TV. Went through a whole bunch of temperature variations and where it's cooling most in the northeast quadrant of Uruguay, which would match up with that same quadrant there at around 30 south. Those two borders connect, Uruguay and Argentina. Now also you'll see Argentina has reduced its wheat exports, just can't grow. So Brazil's out on the market looking for an extra 1.5 million tons of wheat, which Argentina would have supplied. But because of adverse growing conditions in the third La Nina, they're restricting exports because they need to feed their own people. Which kind of you get into this balance here of where will the civil unrest strike first on the planet based on where the food production will cease first? That's a local. But then you need to also look at those same countries that would be importing foods. Well, where are they getting their imports from? If they're getting it from Argentina on the wheat side, they're not getting it because their next door neighbor and their biggest trading partner in Mercosur, Brazil and Argentina, they can't even get the grains out of the next door neighbor. So what do you think somebody in Africa that's buying, do you think they're going to get their share? No, not a chance. Then they'll look up at other places like Ukraine. Oh, wait, sorry, that's not online either. 30% reduction of all grain production in Europe this year. Look at American production, down, down, down 20%. So everywhere you look across the planet, you're starting to see reductions. So these other smaller countries that rely, you know, heavily on imports, they're going to be the first places to rattle. Opportunity there for you if you are an investor in an emerging market and you want to get full value out of your investment, when's your exit point before the fiat collapses? This is another thing to think about that's intertwined into all of this. Civil unrest and the effect on the local economy and the valuation of the fiat in that nation and investments tied to that fiat, all based on this more elephant in the room, if you will. So let's look at Brazil. And we got Paraguay there and Argentina also. So the June, July, August of 2022 is on the left. It's a temperature profile, 3-month overlaid sandwich. So what do we see? I see an emerging top right. You look in Parana State there. And if you go down to the left or west, you'll start to see cooling and Reru, Acre. So what happens there? This is all of South America. So now we're starting to see effects in Peru as well. Which means for me, just on a forecasting trend basis, these areas are going to expand in cooling. Before it wasn't Peru, now it is. Before it was not Brazil North, now it is. Some of these temperature spots where I can try to draw data from, Colombia, on the top right, this is November 20th to 26th. You're starting to see some cooling form up in Colombia. But when you go up there to look into their meteorological bureau, they rely on the United States for their data. So it's not all encompassing where you can get solid quality data points throughout every single nation, because right now I'm mapping all of this and overlaying where the crops are grown in these regions and then subtracting that from global totals and coming out with an end number, and also forecasting on a trend basis where the cooling will continue. So if you want to look at another 12 months, you already know where it's going to amplify at. Top right, that expansion. Notice how the expansion is gradual from June, July, August, then we got September, and now we got into November. And you can see this is in the Southern Hemisphere. They're going into summer, so it should not be cooling in these areas. But when we head into winter, where will it cool most? So the winter and summer variants as well are two things that you need to take into account. Just because it's cooling in the summertime in these regions in northern Brazil, does it mean it'll cool there in the winter also, or it'll be an inverse where wind patterns will change and it'll warm in that area and cool somewhere else? This is kind of the unknown right now, but you know, trying to keep up with 45 different countries on a monthly basis or weekly takes a little bit of time and effort. So I hope you can try to crunch some of the data yourself, at least, you know where to go to look and try to piece some of this together if you are going to do some of your own research. Food production is another main thing to think about at the same time. Okay, these temperature deltas, yeah, it's cooling here, it's cooling there, it's cooling everywhere. Southern Hemisphere. Now, the information I have shows that this water vapor cloud has definitely transited over to at least 40 degrees north latitude now, way up north. So we shall see some cooling happening in the Northern Hemisphere, delayed by about 6 months, but will affect our 2023 crop growing zones. And if we do look back in the year 1816, 1 year after, food production was knocked out at the knees in Vermont, New Hampshire, and New York. It snowed at the end of June in New York, like a foot. Crop production was not forthcoming. They had famines across Europe. But we're one season delayed in the planting from the actual eruption. The eruption happened in the Southern Hemisphere, and they're going into the planting right now. So all accounts across most of those nations, they are not putting it in the fields at the moment. When they should have, months, plural, ago, or even a month ago, late planting would have been 2 weeks, and they're going to have to jack that thing with an enormous amount of potash to get it to grow. What do we see here? Indian farmers boosting their production of wheat. Now, why would they do that? They're already the second largest wheat and exporter on the planet, plus production-wise. They account for 14% of all wheat grown on the planet. But on an acreage basis, the internal consumption takes the lion's share of that. They're expanding their wheat fields 25%. That's what this is showing you here. The farmers in India, second largest wheat grower, they're going to expand up to 25% to grow more food. They understand what's happening also. They understand that the exports that they normally would be able to give to the world, they're going to have to keep it internal. There's going to be a massive push for going to arable lands that were not normally put in use, put into use immediately. Now, they're going to have to do some seasoning. They're probably going to have to, you know, do some work on that. Machinery will need to be brought in to flatten areas, till it, plant it. Irrigation is a whole other thing to think about. But if you do it in the right season and the monsoon's onsetting, then that takes care of itself. But look for an enormous push, if I'm anywhere remotely correct to this crop losses that are happening in the Southern Hemisphere, look for arable lands that are what they consider marginal, non-prime, to be put into 100% full production. Because the thinking is, some production is better than no production. Because if I can get a yield that's even half of the prime lands, like for example, corn, supposedly USDA forecast 187 bushels to 193 bushels per acre in prime land in, say, Iowa. But if you're going to take some of this marginal land and I'm still going to get 90 bushels per acre, and there's some gain in there versus fuel, fertilizers, field maintenance, and preparation, upkeep, etc. If there's a gain of even 10 bushels in there, you're going to watch people flock to it because some is better than none. And when we go into this global famine, he who grows food or she who grows food, you're going to be growing money. They say there is no money tree, but au contraire, there will be. It's called the grains. This is where we're heading in 2023. So put that in perspective. Now, would you buy storable foods? That's a no-brainer. I mean, those things are good for 30 years. If you have the actual physical available cash, if I had $5 million extra dollars, I would buy a warehouse full of food, 30-year storable foods, and just stock it away. The electrical costs on, you know, warehousing some of these things, okay. But that is a no-brainer if you actually have the money and you are liquid cash to be able to buy a physical product that could be traded or sold at a higher price than another day. Storable foods are good for 30 years. We're going to ride through this and, oh, it's going to get nasty in 2024. It's going to get pretty nasty in 23 here. So what is it with the increases that India is seeing that they're so in a panic phase to get every square inch of arable land under production that they're not telling the rest of the world about? And plus, you know, they ceased their wheat exports except some friendly nations that they were dealing with already. Like emergency supplies down to Sri Lanka, for example, who went to 100% organic agriculture. And see, that's the canary in the coal mine right there. Moving to 100% organic ag with no like tapering in phase, that's just dangerous. But that's what a lot of nations are gonna do instantly because they can't get access to chemical fertilizers, which is gonna drive down production even further, where there's gonna go some places that are gonna go offline into massive losses, just like Sri Lanka, because they just couldn't get the fertilizer. So like, we're just going to wing it with some cow dung. Okay. You just lost 50 or 60% of your yield. People are not expecting this. It's going to blindside. I mean, absolutely blindside our planet. What's going on right now. And this one here, these are the top three global producers of each staple crop. This is really a nice piece of information if you're going to use it to explain somebody. Top Brazil, you know, got China, US, India, Russia, Bangladesh. So, you know, staying on the form of India, they got 14.1% of the wheat production slash exports of the planet. And they are in a panic to get more in the ground. So where does that leave places like the United States? There's not much arable land. We're going to go to subprime or, you know, marginal at best. And they're still going to try to put it in production. I spoke at that ag conference back in October. One of the points talked about there was taking marginal lands and turning them into productive lands on a cost basis. On your overage output, is it worth the time and money on a global market? Maybe. Taking 10 extra acres to put it into production? Not really. 100,000 extra marginal acres, if you could buy it and if you can get the leases on it, would be worth the time and effort. Provided they're close, they're connected, and they're in a regional area, and you could get the exclusive lease or buy out everybody else's leases on the marginal lands and put them under one control mechanism. That way, distribution of fertilizers and machinery for harvesting and tilling would all be under, you know, centralized one person making a plan out for the entire zone that would be marginal land buffer zones that are going to be put in production. So it's happening everywhere. And at the same time, you know, looking at China, these massive cold fronts that have been ripping through up there, their food production is already wiped out by the massive droughts, and then it was floods, and then it was droughts, and now it's cold. Perhaps it's a lockdown. You know, I wanted to say one last thing here before we go on the break. This whole China thing was kind of quirky to me anyway, the way they were with the zero policy COVID thing. But look at it through a different lens. Look at it through the food shortage lens. They locked down 100 million people in those little cubicles, and they reduced their diet from 2,500 or 3,000 calories a day to $1,200 or 1,200 calories a day. Delivered to them. So they just knocked out a huge amount of extra calories that could then be moved around the rest of the country. So you know, you're looking at it, is it a forced calorie reduction or is it really a zero COVID policy? And they had to pay their own dollars to stay in there. That was the whole thing, is once you got sent to a quarantine camp in China, you had to pay for it yourself. So it's like you got locked in a box and they rationed your food. And the excuse was the COVID. I'm just saying, now it's a mind experiment, because you got to look at it. During the lockdowns of the COVID initially, what stopped first? All the places you waste food. 40% of all food prepared at a university, at a convention center, at a restaurant, thrown away. Now, restaurants were doing a little bit better with their management on trying to reuse different offcuts to make different dishes, etc. I get it. But in a general food and bev on a concession or, you know, conferences and these sort of things, food was wasted everywhere. So if you were to cut out that food wastage area, okay, they did. They cut it out completely. And then now you start to put people away and ration their diets. Okay, that makes sense too. So we're really coming into it. But what about energy for the rest of the year coming into 2023 also? They have grandiose plans to waste our soybean crop in the United States into renewable ag diesel, renewable diesel. So we'll take a look at that right after the break here. What's pronounced or what's ongoing, or how are they going to even meet these targets? I look at this and say, that's an impossibility. Like, they're currently under construction with broken supply chains, nothing working, base metals, things shut down everywhere. And they're expected to go like 7x increase in terms of production for ag biodiesel and renewable diesel, wasting our food supply, going into food shortages. And that's the plan. It's already bad enough with ethanol. This renewable diesel, by the way, they want to use soybean oil. There's not enough acreage in America, so something has to get cut. Is it going to be the corn to put out more soy acres? That's the plan. We'll discuss this right after the break. David Dubine, right here on TV.